Welcome to the Unafraid Podcast, hosted on the OKC First Podcast Network. My name is Zach Lucero, and I'm the youth and creative pastor here at OKC First. I'm standing on my desk saying, oh, captain, my captain, to my captain, to the captain of this church, we have senior pastor John Middendorf. How are you doing, man?
I am so doing very well. Thank you for that. You always make me laugh. I never know what you're going to say.
So honestly, it makes me laugh. I didn't know what time I was going to say until it was coming out of my mouth. My desk is crumbled because I am overweight.
Now, can you get down? I'm concerned about you being up there. Please get down.
No, you know what? If I'm not allowed to like be near people, I can stand on my desk okay. If I want. All right.
Fair enough.
I just wanted to talk to you a little bit about the state of our church right now. Yeah. And then later we'll have your interview with Mayor David Holt. That's yeah. That's a good get. But yeah. John, could you just talk to us a little bit about the board decision that happened a little bit ago, and also just like what is the trajectory of our church? Where are we headed?
Okay, yeah. So the board met the last Sunday night of April and put together a plan. And I think it feels like everybody has a multi-phase plan, but in our plan certainly is reflective of the other plans that have been handed to us, then that we have to honor. There's the state plan, and then the Mayor Holt actually has some guidelines for us to meet, and we intend to meet those guidelines. We are also gathering information from our insurance people, and there are some guidelines that they'd like for us to follow as well. So here's kind of what it's going to look like. We are not going to gather for the month of May, the entirety of the month of May, not Sundays, not Wednesdays. We're just not going to do it. We're not going to gather. We're going to meet again as a church board. The staff and the board are going to meet again. Having gathered some more information on May the 24th, we have empowered a great guy by the name of Jeremy Lamb, who has put together an impressive collection of people who are on the front lines of the medical effort. So doctors and nurses who are able to monitor the progress of the patients and the progress of the virus, as it were. And he'll be able to tell us on the 24th of May if Oklahoma City is getting stronger and healthier or if it's headed the wrong direction. There are other churches who, during that month of May, are going to be meeting. Like even down the street, there are churches who are going to be meeting and gathering in large quantities. And we're going to get the month of May to kind of monitor whether or not that's working for them and whether or not it causes a spike in the number of cases. We're gonna sit out this entire month, and that's five Sundays in May. We're recording here on the 7th, so four more Sundays. We're going to sit all of that time out, make a determination on the 24th as to when we will try to gather. We think if all things are still tracking in a healthy, positive direction, that we'll try to gather at some point in June. Not exactly sure when that will be. But at some point in June, we'll try to gather. But even then, it will be much different from what we would remember just 4 months ago, let's say, or 2 months ago, actually, even. When we do gather in that next phase, let's call it, it will be in groups of 100 or less. It will be, people will come in one entrance in the church, and then they'll go through something of a pre-check liturgy, let's say.
That's a very nice way of saying
yeah.
that.
Because we want to make sure that folks are healthy as they come into the building, and if we can give people and families the resources they need in order to get or stay healthy, that's what we want to do. And Jeremy's helping us to collect all of those protocols and all of those resources. And so be a temperature scan and those kinds of things, making sure that people have masks. There are some things that we've been asked not to do once we gather. And we're going to think through all of those things, and it won't be a normal service. And like I say, it'll only be 100 at a time.
And that's including people like pastors and techs and all that stuff.
And the whole building. So we can't have another congregation meeting at another part of the facility. So we're actually going to be coordinating with our other congregations. There are nine congregations to coordinate, and we'll figure that out. Prior to that, prior to our gathering 100 at a time, we're going to get on the phones. It will be the staff and other people that we can get to come in and help us, or board members. I don't guess they have to come in. People do have cell phones, but we're going to try to get in touch with everybody and on all of our membership to try to gauge how they're doing, first of all, to gauge whether or not they'd be interested in being a part of these 100 person or less gatherings. And then if they say yes, we want to start to make sure that we populate those 100 person gatherings, because we can't have 150 and we don't want to have 30.
Yeah.
Right. So we want it to be somewhere right there around 100. And we're just trying to get in touch with everybody and just stay in contact and try to figure out how to move forward in that next phase. And honestly, Zach, we don't know how long that phase will last. I don't know how long we're going to be doing that, but we're going to be relying on, as always, the best and most recent medical knowledge and data and policies and strategies. And so that's, we're not going to make this decision any other way. And part of the reason we have that luxury, and it is a luxury, is because our people have been so incredibly supportive and faithful. Everything from helping us to keep a food, our Hope Box stocked. By the way, it's no longer just a Hope Box. It's a Hope Kitchen. And most recently, now it's become the Hope Atrium. I mean, it's just incredible. You've helped us to do other things. We've been able to help Zambia as they enter into this really scary phase. You've been able to help us with other people in our fellowship who have lost jobs or lost income. And then you have given to your church. And so we have the luxury of making a decision that has only to do with medical science. And you've supported the things we've been doing online, the small group things, the kids and youth and college ministries, and then the services. As a church, you have supported that very well. And we feel like we see and hear you, and we feel like that you as a church are saying to us, yeah, we like the way that these decisions are being made, and we like the decisions that are being made. And so we intend to further and continue that trajectory. So we do want desperately to get back together. Don't know how long the 100 at a time phase will last, but we do those kinds of things in the hopes of someday getting back together en masse, everybody together. So I don't know. That's a very long-winded answer to a short question.
No, that's pretty good. No, I like it. I've really admired your leadership throughout this process and even just the thoughtfulness that goes behind a lot of this stuff. I mean, there are churches right now who are opening with minimal restrictions, even, yeah. I've seen. And so have you felt any kind of pressure to be open? Have you felt any kind of pressure for us to open our doors?
Not from our people. I mean, I have had several people, I mean, probably double-digit number of people who have made it a point to reach out to me and say, look, we want to be together. However, we want to do it in a way that is inclusive and not exclusive. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to be flippant about health. So it's not been pressure. It's not been a bad kind of pressure. It is, I've been able to hear people voice their longings to be together, and it matches my own.
Yeah.
Now, there are other churches who are meeting largely without restriction.
Yeah.
And that's a strange dynamic. I can tell you that in the Ministers Alliance that we have helped to cobble together around here called Next Corps, maybe people don't even know that, we've helped put together an alliance of faith communities along Northwest Expressway in the 63rd corridor. And it's a lot of different traditions. And by and large, the prohibitive majority of those people are also not meeting anytime soon. And so it's good to have the support of people like that. But there are churches who aren't a part of Next Corps, though they've been invited, who have opted to go ahead and meet. And yeah, we're watching. And if they flourish, and that's going to be a different kind of pressure, but I don't think it'll ever be the kind of pressure that will cause us to make our decisions any differently. We'll just feel it.
Yeah. Yeah. So what kind of, just for people who don't know, what are some of the things that we're doing right now, aside from just online services and our regular programming? Like what kind of things is our after school, or I guess one, our Neighborhood Empowered, what kind of things are they a part of right now? And like what kind of moves are we making in the midst of all this to help our neighbor?
Yeah, okay. So Kaylee Vaughn, who runs our Neighborhood Empowered, doing a great job. Not only is she monitoring the needs of all of the families who would otherwise have kids in our after-school program that can't right now physically meet, mm-hmm. not only is she monitoring all of those families to see whether or not they they need food or they need hygiene or cleaning supplies, that kind of thing. But she is taking very seriously the opportunity now to help further their educational, their studies, to further their studies. And so she has raised some money, she has made the right kinds of connections, and she's able to get some Chromebooks to students who didn't have them, and has helped to load them with the kinds of programs that they can continue learning, especially, you know, these literacy-focused kinds of things. And Amber Elder, who's on that same board, has really helped us there as well. So one is helping to make sure that kids aren't left out of the education loop. Food-wise, and I mentioned it before, we have dramatically increased our capacity, largely because our people have enabled it by being so generous. But served 50 families that week, and it sounds like today, as we record on the 7th of Thursday, it sounds like we're going to have another big crowd tomorrow to serve. So we've dramatically increased that capacity, so much so that it's caused us to wonder if this is something we ought not to do on a larger scale all the time.
Yeah.
So Britt and Avarilla in particular have started to seek out other funding and resources so that we can house and store more food and a higher quality of food. We are trying to deepen an already built connection with the regional food bank to see if we can't expand that partnership and just help more people more of the time. We're kind of in a food desert here.
Yeah.
The apartments that we serve, they don't eat well. And a lot of the food that they get from places like Circle K. It's not great options. And so we're trying to figure out what that might look like for a church to take seriously, that it might be able to be an oasis in a food desert. Yeah. And so we're going ahead and making those arrangements now. And then the last thing is, during a pandemic, when there is federal and state and even city help available, it seems like it always comes with applications that have to be filled out. And we have an every other week legal clinic that operates here to help people with legal needs, but they are willing to recalibrate. And so those volunteer attorneys and other people in our church have made themselves available to help people fill out that paperwork, whether it's for unemployment or for if you're a small business owner and you need to apply for the payroll protection plan. We have those people around. So we're just trying to network people to resources without feeling like we have to be the originator of all those resources.
Yeah. I love that. Now, you keep asking us as a congregation to spot ways or spot Resurrection Hope.
Yeah.
And I want to turn it on to you. Where do you see Resurrection Hope in the midst of all of this?
So another thing I should have mentioned a minute ago is a photography contest we're doing, which is probably more exhibition than it is contest.
Sure.
We just have asked people, we've asked our photographers to get out there with their cameras to try to spot images of hope and what we would call resurrection hope during the pandemic. If I were to snap pictures, I would snap pictures of people who are being generous with their time, with their donations, who come up and see the opportunity that we have here to be a real and tangible presence of God in the neighborhood. Resurrection is nothing if it's not taking full advantage of the opportunity to be the tangible, touchable presence of God in a life, in a household, in a neighborhood. And I see that. I would snap those pictures of people coming up to clean groceries, of people coming up to sack the groceries, people coming up to welcome and greet the people who are here for food. It's people who on our church board who are coming alongside people who have lost jobs to try to network them with other possibilities, because these are all body skills that will outlast the pandemic and will last on into the future. I see hope in these people because I see a posture that will be here long after the pandemic is gone.
Wow. I love that.
No, it's fun. It's a fun place to pastor. It really is.
Yeah, this is great. Yeah, we didn't actually plan any of this.
No.
We're just going flying by the seat of our pants right now.
Is this called riffing in the business?
This is what's called riffing. We're vamping a little bit. Like we're just kind of doing some give and take, you know. This is what's called rapport, kids.
Ah,
all right. We have a rapport.
I think
our 20th episode. So
this is number 20? There's no cake.
I'm pretty sure this is number 20. Yeah, I feel like we get a cake at 100. So which means we're gonna be here for a lot longer to get to 100.
Man.
I do I was thinking the David Holt interview is just really, really great. I loved even just getting to sit in on it and listen to it. And I feel like David Holt is just one of the most thoughtful, kind, gracious leaders that we could ever ask for. And so, but my one gripe is that we didn't get to do like a true rapid fire question time with him, mostly because we're trying to respect his time.
Right.
And he's a very busy guy. And so I thought I would just pepper you with a few rapid-fire questions. We don't ever get to ask each other the questions, so I think this is our cake right now.
All right.
We just get to do some rapid-fire questions with each other. And I'm just gonna dive in. We'll just I don't know how this is gonna work.
Am I asking you questions too?
I have no idea. We're making this up as we go.
Okay.
So I'm just gonna ask you one, and we'll just kind of see where this ends.
All right.
Your ideal French fries, and that could be from a place or like you could describe texture or taste or whatever, but what is your ideal French fry?
It's the waffle fry from Chick-fil-A.
The waffle fry from Chick-fil-A. Do you have an ideal sauce?
Mm-hmm, Chick-fil-A sauce.
Yes. I dig it.
You realize they never give us all that. Like you and I have gone several times.
I have a gripe with Chick-fil-A.
They never give us the number of sauces that we ask for.
I think we ask for between the two of us, and I'm not going to say who orders what, but I think between the two of us, we get 7. I think we ask for 7, we get 6.
Never, ever get 7.
We've never gotten 7. We've gotten 6, but we've never gotten 7. 7 is like kind of a special biblical number in some sense.
They smile so kindly and say, oh, for sure. Yeah, we'll give you. Then they'll like radio back and say, do not under any circumstances give these people 7.
6. That's it.
What about you? Your favorite fry?
Well, my favorite fry would be, and it's not 100% accurate all the time because it just depends on the day. But like when McDonald's gets their fries right.
Right.
It is like heaven on earth. It is like they're not I need mine to be not like soggy, but not crispy, like just that perfect in the middle, like perfectly salted, like pretty warm. You know, I don't need like blazing hot fries because
there's a Malcolm Gladwell episode on, I think it's in Revisionist History, about when the McDonald's fry changed and why it changed.
Oh, I haven't.
Fascinating.
Heard that one. Oh, why did it change? Do you know?
I think it was a health-related sort of reason.
Yeah, so they're healthier now?
I think they're healthier now, but I don't think there's as much sugar, I think, is the thing. There's not as much sugar in them.
Dude, I went on Whole30 for 30 days one time, and I just didn't realize everything has sugar in it.
Everything like, has sugar
everything.
In it.
The air has sugar in it. I'm pretty sure we're ingesting sugar right now. let's see. If you're going to eat local in Oklahoma City, where are you going?
If I'm going to eat local in Oklahoma City, we somehow find our way to Cafe 7 a lot. But we also like places. We like kind of the hole-in-the-wall Chinese places.
Yeah.
We like those places. And we like the – I'm trying to think of we like the Garage. Is that local?
Yeah, it's local.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's local.
Like
I mean,
the garage.
We all have a garage, so
yeah,
that's pretty local.
But I will tell you, pandemic being what it is, the prohibitive majority of our meals are eaten at home now.
Yeah, it's wild. We all have to cook now.
Yeah, I don't know if that changes.
Maybe
for us.
I've Postmated a lot of stuff.
So, have you really?
Yeah, I've partaken in that, but.
We haven't Postmated very much. I don't know. I have like an allergy to it.
Are you scared of it?
I don't know. It's just.
Is it, John? Is it an age thing?
I mean, I guess it could be. No, I know how to use it. We've used it, but maybe that's my need to get out of the house.
Yeah.
It's not that we haven't eaten takeout, but I want to go get it.
That's true. I do like driving to go get it.
Yeah, that might be it. As long as I can do so safely.
Yeah, that's fair.
What about you?
If I'm going to eat local, I love the Mule. And they just put one in.
Good.
They just, it's there's I think they just did, or at least I just discovered that there's one in Edmond.
That's right.
Right by, because I was getting on Postmates and I was just looking for stuff and I was like, what? That's like a mile away from my house?
Yeah.
When did that happen?
Yeah. Awesome. I haven't been yet. I'd like to do that.
Yep. I do love the Mule. Let's get weird. Let's see. If you're gonna name a cat a human name, I don't think you've ever answered this on the pod before. What would you name it?
Well, I did tell you that as a child we did have a cat named Adam.
That's right. Okay, Adam's a good cat name.
But if I've been thinking about this a lot, I think if I were there are people who are allergic to cats at my house. But if somehow they were to be cured of such a thing and they were to want a cat, we would get a little girl cat, right? I think I would want to name it Beth.
That's a good one.
I don't know why. Or Linda.
Hello, Linda. Karen. Get out of here, Karen. Mine is well known at this point. Derek.
Derek.
My cat, Derek. So yeah. Please come up with a different question.
All right. I know you play the guitar.
I do. I've played it before.
What is the musical instrument that you don't know how to play that you really wish you knew how to play?
Okay. So last time you asked me this question, it was a hammer dulcimer.
Oh, yeah.
And... there's multiple things, so I mean, I can't just leave it to that. I've always wanted to be a saxophone guy. Like, I've always wanted, like, I think they're the most annoying people on the planet, so super sorry for my saxophone player friends. Like, you guys are all just too cool for us, but I would love to just be able to just be like, hey, Natalie, here's my saxophone. That'd be awesome.
Fantastic.
I could just play Careless Whisper. That's all I want to know the saxophone for. Maybe I'll just learn Careless Whisper and call it a day.
That's fantastic.
I'm going to do one more. You know, you've gotten asked this question a lot, and I've never gotten to ask it before. If you were to be on stage, let's say you play guitar, and you're just so amped, and you want to smash that guitar on the ground, what song is it to?
Foo Fighters, Best of You.
You've thought about this, haven't you?
Yeah.
Like a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Foo Fighters.
Foo Fighters, Best of You. Yeah, I have thought about it. Actually, I actually went out and smashed a guitar just one time just to see if that was true.
I have one in here if you want to just do it. Like right now. Just get a sound of it. But, yeah.
What about you?
Last time I said like... Oh, I mentioned So Will I last time, which was good.
Which is a praise song.
And Shoot the Thrill. Maybe I'll pick another worship song, you know? I don't know. This truly is the hardest question that we ask.
What's the song that has the lyric, huge bell I ring? Some song I sing, a huge bell I ring.
Wait, is this a Christian song?
Yeah, because that's the one that gets Jason Smith. Like, if he had a guitar on the front row, he would smash it when that song gets played.
I don't know, but if I was a better Nazarene, I'd say Holiness Unto the Lord.
When
the full clergy choir sings it. Because it's just this big mass sound of dudes singing Holiness Unto the Lord is our what word song.
Just hand out guitars to everyone.
Just so much testosterone. Hey, but we're chiseling away at that. We're starting to, you know, tip those scales into the female direction, and I'm here for it.
We need more parts.
Mostly because I want that song to sound less like a dude choir. And more like an actual, you know.
Actual choir.
Yeah, dude, choirs aren't real choirs. You heard it here, folks. Okay, I think we're done vamping. We've run out of topics.
That's not
true. We haven't run out, but we just don't want to bore you. And without further ado, John's interview with Mayor David Holt.
My honor to have my friend Mayor Holt here for our podcast today. Mayor Holt, thank you very much. We know you're very busy. Thank you for taking this time with us.
Yeah, thank you. It's my pleasure.
So first question is just how are you holding up? I know this has to be a grinder. How are you doing? And then how is your family doing given what you do for a living?
Well, it's, it was definitely 24/7 there for a long time. As we sit here now, you know, it's settled down a little bit. Which is kind of like saying the Germans are only bombing us every other day now, I guess, but it's still pretty crazy. But as I said, I mean, really it's not quite 24/7. I mean, I can kind of, do a few other things now. As far as the family goes, I mean, that's been the upside of this. And I'm sure that's true for a lot of people. You know, I've been at home, with modern technology, I can be on CNN or in a council meeting all from my living room, you know, and that's what I've been doing. So I've been home, you know, 98% of the time, if not more, since this really got going. And, you know, that time with family has been nice. You know, yeah. We take walks, we have family movie nights. Those are not things that we always had time for, it seemed, in the past. So even though it's like, it feels like it's 24/7 COVID-19, my physical presence here has allowed us to, you know, just be around each other a lot. Rachel's very busy. She's the head of a state agency, the Office of Juvenile Affairs. So she's, you know, just as in the middle of it as I am. But again, we're all sort of here together. And so I've tried to, obviously, as much as possible, focus on the bright side of it as well. And that's been part of that.
Yeah, that's kind of been your persona, even as I've watched all of these appearances you've made on some of the national news shows. Is that an intentional thing? Like when you go on those shows, are you trying to be the mayor of Oklahoma City, looking at the bright side, or looking on the bright side, or how have you thought that through?
I think it's just who I am, really. Honestly, I don't necessarily think of it strategically. I mean, I'm just at some point I chose to be an optimistic leader, I guess, and it's just intrinsic to who I am now. I think leaders, you know, should always be optimistic. That doesn't mean you're lying to people. And I certainly have been pretty brutally honest with people about this virus. So, you know, it wasn't necessarily a time for optimism early on when I really needed people to understand how serious this was. But at the same time, if you can find some silver linings here and try to plant some seeds of hope, I mean, that's certainly, I think, part of my charge is to do that.
I love that. And you have peddled hope very well, by the way. And all the while making at least dozens of dollars annually from the city. I appreciate that you do. And I mentioned Boria before, if you'd like, we are happy to have a bake sale or a car wash to just to add to your salary if you'd like. Just please tell your wife. Hey, it's May the 7th.
Go ahead. Oh, well, I get amused, a few times, I guess because, you know, the virus really forced everybody around the country to shut down businesses and stuff. I'll get these people, messaging me on social media saying like, well, you know, why don't you give up your salary? You're still getting paid, you know, and I'm like, I just let it go because it's just too much to explain. But obviously, they don't know what mayor of Oklahoma City gets paid. So,
by the way, what is the thinking behind that? Why is that not a well-paid position?
Well, it's, you know, in our form of government, there's this idea, that you have the city manager, and so that the mayor and council are you know, not going to be very hands-on. But I mean, the reality of it is, everybody looks at their mayor. Everybody's seen movies. They know what mayors do. You know, the people of my city look at their mayor just the same as the people of Los Angeles look at their mayor. You know, nobody wants to be pawned off on the city manager that they don't vote for. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to talk to the mayor. You know, mm-hmm. They want to see the mayor in charge of a crisis like COVID-19. You know, they want to see the mayor doing these things and be out and about. So it's just it's a outdated, archaic idea of the job created 90 years ago that just doesn't, you know, fit with modern expectations. And so the reason that's the philosophy behind it, you know, the reason it's that philosophy hasn't changed is that the salary is in the charter. And so the charter is subject to amendment only through a vote of the people. And so, you know, how many mayors and council members are going to, you know, spend their political capital to try and give themselves economic capital, you know, and so that's what it would take. I mean, I'd have to go we'd have to take it to a council meeting. There'd be a lot of media coverage. I would have to say, this is what I think the people of Oklahoma City should be voting on. The next election is giving me a raise, you know, and nobody, you know, how it's pretty unique that any mayor in my position wants to do that. We signed up for the job with the salary that it had. And would I like to fix it for the future? Yeah, you know, but now's not the time. We actually created a charter change committee at the beginning of this year, and salaries were certainly going to be discussed in that context. But now with what's happened with COVID and, and, you know, obviously these looming budget cuts that we'll have to take at the city level, it's just totally off the table. So, you know, someday I would love to leave a legacy of fixing that for the future, because it shrinks the pool of people who can even consider running for this. And obviously it means you have to do another job, which I do. I have another job, to actually make a living. And, you know, that's not always in the best interest of the citizenry for us to have other jobs and have to be distracted. You know, I'm mayor of America's 27th largest city. I mean, this is a big deal. Yeah. And, I make it work, and I've got an employer that's, you know, obviously, very benevolent and has accepted this. But yeah, I mean, it eats you up. I mean, it's trying to basically do two full-time jobs and have a family is obviously a 24/7, job in itself.
Yeah. And I don't envy you for that. but I want to say again, I sure appreciate your posture through this. Can I ask you a couple of questions relative to the city and COVID-19?
Of course.
Tell me where you think we're at right now. Do you feel like we are, just kind of give us your assessment of the relative health of the city and where you think we're headed and any concerns you might have as we reopen.
Yeah, well, my message on where we're at has been pretty consistent the last few weeks, because the data has been pretty consistent. And, you know, the answer is, if you were to compare what we're going through to a normal virus, like a normal flu season or something, it's not going well at all. You know, we have, as we sit here, we have over 70 deaths in just, you know, 6 weeks. We have thousands of cases across the state and well over 1,000 here in Oklahoma City Metro. And so you'd have to say this is the worst virus we've had probably in 100 years. But if you were to compare it to our experience, if you were to compare it to, you know, what's going on in New York, New Orleans, Detroit, Seattle, and other cities around the world, you'd say, well, it could be much worse, and it's going pretty well relative to those other places. And I think that's really just attributable to the fact that we acted early, we acted aggressively, we put the social distancing measures in place very quickly upon having our very first case. And I think that has saved thousands of lives. And it's not theoretical, you know, you just have to look at what's happened in other cities and compare their per capita deaths to our per capita deaths. And you can see that we as a community did the hard work to save a lot of people's lives. And so all in all, relative to other places, it's going okay. But that could change on a dime, because there's still hundreds of people right now in Oklahoma City walking around with COVID-19. And if we don't continue to be cognizant of that, and we just sort of live our lives like we did as recently as February, you know, we can lose all of this progress that we've had. So we just got to keep it up, even though, you know, we're returning to some quote unquote high risk activities that, you know, we haven't enjoyed in the last few weeks. As those begin to return, they can be navigated as long as you keep your distance, you wash your hands, you wear a mask, you follow the guidelines that have been put out there for things like salons and restaurants and gyms. I think we're all kind of conditioned now, and I think we're maybe as individuals a lot more ready for this next phase than we were, you know, back on March 15th. And it's a phase, in a sense, that's going to last a very long time, which is another thing I try to prepare everybody for, is this is not going to be out of our lives completely until there's a vaccine or a proven treatment. And that may be many, many months, maybe years, you know? Yeah. And so these measures you're seeing us take now, they may continue to adapt a little bit, but we're not just going to take our masks off and hug each other anytime soon. And that's really important for everybody to understand. But so far, so good. I feel like they are understanding it, and I feel like the data bears that out.
So do you have in mind, and you may have something in mind, you may not want to make it public just yet, but what kind of metric measurement, let's say, would it take for you to say, okay, hang on, we're going to have to lock everything back down? Is that a hospitalizations thing, or is it a death toll thing, or what would you say?
Well, we look at hospitalization rates, we look at death toll, we look at new cases, we look at the percentage of people that are testing positive mm-hmm. at our testing sites mm-hmm. and whether that percentage is growing. We look at, there's a thing in the public health world called syndromic surveillance and symptoms. Basically, the hospitals are reporting the symptoms they're seeing, and those numbers also kind of figure into all of this. And that's an early warrant, you know, it's kind of an early barometer. We look at all of that stuff. And I don't know, I always, people want me to say sometimes like a specific data mm-hmm. point, like this is the trigger. And I think that's unwise because there's so many different data points and so much subjectivity that can come into yeah. it. I think we need to retain our ability to you know, to make a nuanced decision and not have some robotic, you know, number that suddenly is going to trigger everything. What I generally say is, for purposes of considering whether we would step back and close things again, I always say something like a dramatic change or a spike or something, you know. And I guess what I'm trying to send with that kind of language is the message that it's not going to be just because things get a little bit worse. It's got to be, you know, fairly dramatic. It's mm-hmm. got to be obvious that, especially that the openings that we did caused something. As we sit here today, we're, you know, a week after May 1st, we are not seeing that yet at all. In fact, the numbers yeah. are still declining in all of those categories I just described here in Oklahoma City. But we look at them every single day and we'll certainly continue to look for that spike or that surge or whatever word you want to use that would indicate things have really turned. And then I really feel like not just public health officials, but the governor and mayors would recognize that something's got to be done in that case.
Yeah. So there was one particular speech that struck me and I read it and then I watched it and I sensed in you something that resonated with me. This was in the leak leading up to April 30th. And so we hadn't yet reached our city's opening day. And yet the state had already kind of opened up a little bit. And you gave a speech that clearly identified you as a team player. You want to be a participant. And yet portions of that speech, I would swear, were delivered through gritted teeth. You even said at one point, this is not what I would choose. I'm very right. curious. And that resonated with me because there are times when, as a pastor and a pastor of this church, you find yourself in that similar kind of predicament. I'm a part of a larger body, a larger community, a larger movement, the Church of the Nazarene. And so we're going to do mm-hmm. this, but I am not sure that this is the right thing, but I see the value being connected to a larger body. Like, I'm curious mm-hmm. what was going through your mind and heart as you delivered that particular speech.
Well, I have always felt like some people think leadership is just telling everybody what we're doing without really explaining it. And there are some people who respond to that and they like that kind of leadership. They just want to be told what to do. But I find in America that most people want to have a more transparent style, a style that explains the thought process that went into it. So I've always had that as my ideal, is that I always want to bring people along with the thought process I went through. And I have always found that they respond well, that even if they didn't necessarily like the outcome, if they saw your thought process, they tend to say, okay, I get it. Like, you did consider my side of it and you went a different direction, but at least I understand why and I can see how you got there. So in this case, you know, I mean, the governor had lifted restrictions, which creates almost a futility if Oklahoma City were yeah. to continue restrictions, because I'm only mayor of half the people who live in the metro. So that's right. clearly a major factor. On the other side of it, you know, it's there's a sense that any lifting of restrictions is going to cause more opportunities for spreading the virus. So that's bad. On the other side of it, okay, if you can put some conditions in place, maybe you can mitigate the downside of opening up these activities. Also, the White House put out some gating criteria, as they call it. And we were referring to some of those data points a minute ago. It was pretty reasonable. And our public health officials thought that gating criteria that the White House had created was pretty good. And we passed it, narrowly, but, we just barely seemed to meet that gating criteria. So that was sort of a objective way to decide, well, this is the time to do it, I guess. I think on the other side, I'm kind of walking you in a, it's basically a shortened version of my speech. I'm kind of walking you through the pros and the cons. On the other side of it was I just didn't feel good about it. And a lot of people didn't, And it just felt like too soon. And that was more of a gut thing. But then, in counter to that, and I said all of this in the speech, essentially, I said, but you know what? I also have to acknowledge I'm never going to feel good about this until there's a vaccine. And we know there's not going to be a vaccine for like 2 years. So we could be having this conversation in June, July, August, September. I'm still going to have these misgivings because I'm going to know that there's this potential for opening up more opportunities for spreading the virus and more people are going to get sick. So, but I know that we can't shelter in place for 2 years. So I'm just at some point, I'm just going to have to accept it, that we're just going to move forward into a new phase and try to make the best of it and try to have these conditions on it that assure some level of safety. So I put all of that, hopefully more eloquently, into that speech and kind of helped people, I think, see all the inner turmoil that has to occur in a decision like that. And it did seem like it was, it created the reaction that I guess I wanted, which was people understanding, whether they liked it or not, they understood and could kind of accept, that this was what we were going to do. And probably the thing that was, of all the stuff I just said, probably the most conclusive issue was the fact that the state was lifting its restrictions. And so therefore, unless all of the cities in the metro banded together, and that was not going to happen, there would be really no practical reason for Oklahoma City to try to do something that the other cities weren't going to do. It just was, there would be no public health benefit. I mean, where your church is like, a mile from another city, 2 miles from yet another city, about 3 miles from another city. I mean, like, it'd be silly to think that, a dining room at the Red Lobster across the street from you could be closed, and that there would be a public health benefit to that when the dining room at Incredible Pizza is open, miles down the road.
Right. By the way, just so you know, later on, I am going to seek your endorsement as your favorite Nazarene church on this side of Northwest Expressway. Okay. So what you did accomplish, though, in that speech, which is, again, I resonated with it because there are times when I want folks to kind of get this from a sermon, is you got people to sense that this was difficult. And I think the empathy that resulted in your being able to communicate that this is a difficult decision, a decision in which there was no clear-cut right answer. I think you won hearts and minds because you were able to communicate that difficulty. So my question is, how did you learn that particular leadership style? Who are the influencers where David Holt is concerned? Maybe there are books or experiences, but how would you describe your leadership style and where did it come from?
Well, I had, despite my relative youth as mayor of Oklahoma City, I'm the youngest mayor in 100 years, I have had more experience at this than most people. I've been in elected office for a decade. I've been in around politics for my entire adult life. I've worked in the White House. I've worked in the U.S. Capitol. I've worked at the state capitol. I've worked at City Hall. So I think I have, and I'm like a sponge. So I think I've just sort of instinctively kind of analyzed and digested all of that, which I have seen over the last 20 years. And that's, in a sense, what forms the type of political leader that I am and try to be. I don't know that there's any particular one person. I try to take the best things I see from everybody, I guess. I don't know. And I also, I mean, I think in a sense, I try to be unique. I mean, I just try to be who I think should be, you know, what I think a political leader should be. And I don't necessarily know that I have a perfect political leader in history or current politics to point to. I just try to be that person, you know. And so, you know, you could say, well, you know, if you started to pick apart things I do, I mean, maybe I could try to tie it to somebody else that I've observed. But ultimately, I just try to be myself, and I try to build off of all the things I've experienced and all the things I've tried and all the things I've seen. And I've had, like I said, a lot of experiences, a lot of opportunities to watch others, and also serving in the legislature. If you're active at that, you know, I passed 70 bills into law through the course of my 8 years in the Senate, and every one of those is an epic story. I mean, pieces of legislation are so hard to pass. It's a wonder we ever pass any, it seems to me. Yeah. And, you know, to get all the battles and war stories that were a part of every one of those bills taught me something. And those are lessons I'll use in whatever office I have. But along with that, or all the times I was in the mayor's office, the times I was in the White House, I mean, I've gotten to see leaders at all levels of government, and I think I've sort of just instinctively processed all of that into who I am today. Yeah. And it's speeches like that, which I've written all my COVID-19 speeches. I don't know if you write your sermons, but I don't usually write speeches. I write my state of the city, and that's about it. And I have deviated from that with COVID-19 because there's just so much information I want to impart, and I want to do so in an organized and eloquent way. And so I wrote that speech in advance that afternoon before and into the morning of the event. And I've done that, I guess, however many times I've given a COVID-19 speech. I think it's about 9 or 10 times now. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's part of my method with this so far, and may not seem like a big deal, but for me it is. To write a speech is something I very rarely do, but I felt it necessary here.
I'm just curious, you've said a couple times now you're in the White House. What role did you have in the White House, and who was president during that time?
Sure. So I just a quick biographical sketch. I was born and raised here in Oklahoma City. I went to Putnam City North High School. I went out to D.C. to go to college at George Washington. And my first real job coming out of college was for the Speaker of the House. And then I did that for a little over a year. 9/11 happened during that time. So I was in the U.S. Capitol on 9/11 and in its aftermath. And then in May of 2002, I went to work. I can't believe that's now that that's exactly 18 months ago, but I went 18 years ago. But I went to work for President Bush in mm-hmm. legislative affairs. So legislative affairs is kind of like the president's lobbyist to Congress, you know, yeah. And I worked in the House side, dealing with the House of Representatives, I mean, and I worked physically in the East Wing, which is very cool. I mean, actually, all these people you hear working, unquote, in the White House are actually typically working in the executive office building or, you know, some other building. But yeah. Legislative affairs happens to be the only office where everybody's actually in the White House, in this case, in the East Wing. And it's a pretty small, you know, the White House isn't actually all that big. So, you know, it was a very cool, surreal experience for somebody at my age, very junior level. I mean, don't get me wrong, but nevertheless, you know, you had that proximity to the action. And so it was a very, very great, very cool experience at a very young age. I guess I was 23 when I started working there.
Good grief. You couldn't even rent a car yet.
That's right. I could not.
So you would have been around then when President Bush's faith, I believe he was asked a question about prayer and whether or not he would pray about a particular decision. I think it was a foreign policy decision of some kind. And I remember he really took something of a beating from folks. Probably, I don't know this for sure, but probably outside of a faith tradition who said, man, I don't know that I want to leave foreign policy decisions or any big decision up to the prayer life of somebody, especially when that person making that critique doesn't even believe in prayer or God. So Now, are you still, I believe you're still over at Canterbury. Is that right? Episcopal Church?
Correct. Yes. We, St. Augustine of Canterbury up by Quell Springs Mall, Father Joseph Alsay is our rector.
He is a crazy person, by the way. I love him to death, but he is certifiable. So my question to you is, what role does faith play as you govern? Like, how does it impact how David Holt does the mayor's job?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, as an Episcopalian, I don't necessarily wear faith on my sleeve, and I've been a lifelong Episcopalian. That's just from birth, really. You know, that was what my parents attended, and I've had no reason to change. And I've probably, through the course of my life, been a member of virtually every Episcopal church, at least on the north side of Oklahoma City. In a city like Oklahoma City, in a state like Oklahoma, where obviously there's a lot of evangelicals, my faith may not seem as apparent, you know, but I don't think that Episcopalians are any less faithful. They're just, and I don't necessarily have a good bead on how a Nazarene, illustrates their faith, but
if
it might be
tell anybody,
closer.
I will tell you that we share a very similar family tree. we're a whole lot closer to the Episcopalians than we are other branches of the evangelical church.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fair. I also, on top of that, you know, I tend to, want to be a very inclusive leader, and I recognize that especially explicit expressions of Christian faith by a mayor or a governor or a president, you know, can be somewhat excluding to a not insignificant number of people. You know, I mean, we all live in these echo chambers, and you can live in Oklahoma City and be under the impression everybody around you is a practicing Christian, when in reality, that's, I don't know, you'd know better than I, but I mean, you know, there's a lot of people who are not. Right. They're either not really affiliated with any church, or they're Muslim or Jewish, or maybe even explicitly atheists, you know, and that number, you know, all of that starts to add up to, you know, a good third or more of the community, if not nearly half. And so I don't want to be a leader who's excluding those people. To the extent that I allude to faith publicly, it would probably be more in a more general context about faith and about God, you know, but it probably would, I would typically avoid, Christian language that would be excluding of so many people.
Right.
It's fine that others do that, but you know, I want to be a little more inclusive. So between being Episcopalian and being sort of an inclusive leader, it tends to limit how much I express that, but I nevertheless feel it. And so to really bring it back around and answer your question, I think faith plays a role, and we go to church and I pray and all of those things. It's a little different probably than some people. And I think people get the wrong impression sometimes when they hear comments like you just expressed from President Bush, because they hear people say things that makes it sound like they're having this, you know, out loud two-way conversation, yeah. You know, and it kind of weirds them out or something, yeah. You know, and I'm so I don't know. I don't necessarily see my relationship with God as quite that vocal, you know, but I think he certainly guides me in the decisions I make and in the places he puts me. And at moments like of crisis like this, you know, I definitely feel an obligation in a sense that, you know, that I was placed here for this moment.
Sure. That's a great answer. I think, like Episcopalians, we Nazarenes understand ourselves to be the product of our habits and practices, such that we don't always have to wear things like badges. We can just kind of be the person we've been built to be. Hey, I know your time is short, and you've been gracious. I just want to rattle off a couple of questions, and then we'll knock it out here. What is your dream job?
Well, I mean, in all sincerity, there may be a time to do something else in politics, but I will never have as much fun as I am having as the mayor of Oklahoma City, and I say that even in the middle of a pandemic. I mean, it's a great job. I should say being mayor is a great job. Being mayor of your hometown is an even better job. You know, there'll be people who'll say, oh, you should run for governor. And to me, I'm like, that is a lateral move at best. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, like, being mayor means being at the center of the economic and cultural engine of your community and of your state. You know, I mean, big, especially if you're mayor of a big city. I mean, cities are, to me, where it is at in the 21st century. Mm-hmm. States, to me, are more of a political designation. You know, nobody ever says they're from if they live in a city, they say they're from that city. They don't say what state they're from, you know, other than maybe Texans, you know, but like, but everybody else would tell you what city they're from. That's their identity, you know? So I feel very blessed to be the mayor. And again, I may do something else different at some point, because you just have to eventually, but I don't think I'll ever have as much fun as this is. And people will think, maybe if I did something else someday, that I've moved up the ladder, but I won't necessarily feel that way. Cause at the mayoral level, you can really see, you can really affect change, and you can see the impact of your work. You really affect lives in a positive way, hopefully. And that's, so I think I'm in essentially my dream job right now. But you know, I'll rationalize it later if I ever have to do something else, you know, and I'll love that job too. But right now, I mean, it's hard to beat being the mayor of a big city in America. There's really no better job. And I think you see that so much discussed in the current political atmosphere. I mean, mayors have played a huge role in COVID-19. And I think it's more and more recognized that really mayors, in my view, have kind of supplanted the traditional view of governors being the leaders around the country. And you saw, you know, multiple mayors making incredible runs for president that didn't mm-hmm. work out for any of them. But again, I just think we're in a moment where people are really realizing that cities are what make America special right now. And mayors are what make cities special. And so I feel honored and blessed to be one of them.
How about your, I'm going to ask you three more. I'm going to tell you what they are. Your favorite recent development in Oklahoma City, your favorite place just to be in Oklahoma City outside of your home or your church. Okay. Uh-huh. And then 10 years from now, David Holt will be drawing a paycheck by doing what?
Well, I mean, I don't know if this qualifies. You didn't qualify development with public or private, but I mean, for me, I mean, Scissortail Park is pretty special place, and it was really cool to open it the way we did. And so I'm very partial to that right now.
Did you rehearse that drop the mic move before you did it, or was that spontaneous?
No, I didn't even know I was going to do that. I've looked back on that, trying to analyze how I got to that moment of the day, you know, and I think it was just all the energy of the whole day culminated in that moment.
That was great.
So I'd say Scissortail Park. You asked, where do I like to be other than my house or
in
church?
The city.
I don't go a lot of other places, but I don't go anywhere now. But, you know, I think City Hall, honestly, is a gorgeous building, and I have a wonderful office there. Yeah. And what you've seen. And I would encourage anyone, when we're actually doing things again and when the building's open again, to check it out. A lot of people don't know where Oklahoma City Hall is. They kind of live their whole lives sort of missing it. It's right in the middle of a bunch of things they know about, but they should come by and see it. It's a beautiful Art Deco building. And then finally, 10 years from now, I really don't know. I mean, I would say, I hope it's some sort of service, you know. It doesn't, and service does not have to exclusively be elected office. But I think, you know, my whole life has been about that kind of work. And so even if it's part-time like this sort of supposedly is or whatever, you know, I hope that, I always have an outlet for helping others. It's rewarding and it's diverse too. I mean, those are kind of the two reasons I always cite as why I even got into this in the first place, is I like helping people. It makes you feel good. And also these types of jobs are just different every single day, you know, and that's just, you know, an engaging aspect. Everybody wants to do a job that's, you know, fun and challenging and different every day. And that's certainly public service. So whether it's being in elected office or being in an appointed office or being, you know, in a university setting or something, I just hope it's, yeah, that it's a sense where I'm fulfilled and where I'm helping and serving others.
Not surprised at all. I'm going to get you out of here on this one. Your favorite church, Nazarene Church, on the south side of Northwest Expressway, pastored by a person in this virtual meeting.
Yours, of course. Yes.
Correct. I think that's the correct answer. You nailed it.
You're a good lawyer, in addition to being a good pastor.
Hey, man, it's always good to work with you on stuff, and we've been honored to have you on this show. We've had you in the building before, and we'll look to work with you on other things. Let us know if you need something. We want to be that kind of church, so let us know if we can help you what you do.
No, I'm very grateful for your leadership and your church's leadership. You do want to be that kind of church. That's obvious. You want to be a church that's very much a part of your broader community, and that's extremely appreciated. And it's noticed, and you're definitely one of the leading churches in our city in terms of being, you know, trying to broaden your service beyond just your congregation and out into your community. And that's a great thing. Very admirable. So thank you.
I appreciate it. We're going to do that bake sale here in the next couple of months. I think that idea's got legs, man. Just let me know. Hey, I appreciate it. Take care of yourself. You're doing a great job, and we're glad that you're our mayor. Take care.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Be well. Appreciate you. Take care.
Okay.